Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. After 36 years of exhaustive research, writing a book on the assassination, and interviewing hundreds of witnesses, one question still looms large. Did Lee Harvey Oswald kill President John F. Kennedy? My answer to that is a resounding no. To even ask who killed Kennedy, if not Oswald, is to entertain the possibility of a conspiracy. But after decades of studying the evidence, I can't ignore what we've uncovered. So if Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill President Kennedy, then who did? In the episodes ahead, we begin our investigation into the individuals and organizations that may have played a role in the assassination. We'll examine the intelligence community's fingerprints on Oswald's movements and associations. We'll look at the role of anti-Castro Cuban exiles, many of whom had deep ties to U.S. intelligence and a motive rooted in betrayal. Then we'll look at the shadowy network of organized crime, which had both the means and motive to silence Kennedy. And finally, we'll look at key figures in the Dallas law enforcement community and local politics, whose actions raise serious questions about their possible role in the assassination. Each of these threads lead us closer to understanding not just who pulled the trigger, but who orchestrated the cover-up and why. Join me as we peel back the layers of deception and follow the evidence wherever it leads. The truth didn't die in Dealey Plaza. It's waiting to be uncovered. In this week's episode, we continue to look at the man that they call Madryn. Several books, television programs, and many podcasts have been focused on an ex-Dallas police officer that many researchers think was a trigger man who really killed JFK. That man is Roscoe White. Over the next few episodes, we're going to listen to a news special I recorded almost 30 years ago. We started this series in the last episode, and if you missed it, I suggest you go back and listen to that episode 129 to get caught up to where our episode today picks back up on the trail. This series, produced by TV news journalist Becky Neighbors from Big 2 News in Odessa, Texas, explores the theory of Roscoe White being the assassin that killed John Kennedy in 1963. In 1990, Ricky White, the son of Roscoe White, brought his story to Larry Howard and other researchers at the JFK Assassination Information Center in Dallas. Ricky White claimed to have evidence that proved his father, Roscoe White, was the gunman behind the picket fence in Dealey Plaza and had delivered the fatal shots that struck President Kennedy in the head. Roscoe White was working as a Dallas police officer at the time of the shooting. Roscoe White was also in the same military division as Lee Harvey Oswald, and the two were stationed together in Marine Air Wing 1 at Japan's Aksugi Air Base. Roscoe White had a wife named Geneva, who worked for Jack Ruby at the Carousel Club. There is some evidence to suggest that Officer J.D. Tippett also was acquainted with the White family. So today is part two of a three-part series of the man they call Madryn, Roscoe White. After we hear this three-part series, I will then break down the evidence against Roscoe White, talk about what we've learned about him since this special aired, and come to a conclusion if he could have been the shooter on the grassy knoll that fateful day in Dallas. This is just the beginning of our series we're calling, If Lee Harvey Oswald Didn't Kill President Kennedy, Then Who Did?
Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Public shattered by the assassination of a president in 1963 would experience even more chaos in the late 60s. The Vietnam War escalates, civil rights leader Martin Luther King is slain, and Robert Kennedy is assassinated in Los Angeles as he's campaigning for president. But these events couldn't prepare our country for what it's about to see. In 1975, 12 years after his murder, the American public would be shocked when it sees a film showing John Kennedy's execution. And for Midlander Ricky White, this same year, he and his mother would be questioned by Washington investigators looking into the alleged conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination. Tonight, we we continue our series of exclusive reports, JFK, the West Texas Connection. Viewer discretion is advised.
President John F. Kennedy is getting a warm welcome this morning here in Fort Worth, the third stop in his whirlwind trip through our state.
It's 1973 when this movie Executive Action, starring Burt Lancaster, hits theaters across the country. The movie is based on the book Rush to Judgment by author and Washington attorney Mark Lane. This Hollywood version of the assassination of President Kennedy would for the first time allege a conspiracy.
Secret Service are under regular orders to stay with the president no matter what happens. Once they get him to the hospital, they'll probably filter back. But for at least a half hour, you should be entirely free of them.
I'll have six men with Secret Service credentials in Dealey Plaza. Their insignia for this trip, incidentally, is double white bars on red.
Lane, who wrote the screenplay, says orders from upper management forced him to take out any CIA connection in the plot. Lane says the movie was a financial success, but short-lived. 2 weeks after its premiere, it was pulled out of theaters, and by 6 months would completely disappear until 1991, when it was released again, this time on video. But whose order did the film get pulled? Lane says no one knows for sure. Let's now fast forward to 1975. Allegations of a cover-up explode when Americans see for the first time Kennedy's execution. It's called the Zapruder film, shot by Abraham Zapruder, who captured the president's arrival in Dealey Plaza.
As the car came down, the last shot hit him on the street in front of us.
Researchers say as you look closely at the film, it shows the probability Kennedy could have been shot by a bullet fired from the front. Although he didn't know it at the time, in 1975, the same year the Zapruder film was released, Midlander Ricky White would have a brush with his father's secret identity. An identity he says he now knows as the gunman behind the grassy knoll.
In 1975, Paris, Texas, there was a break-in in where Ricky White and his mother lived. And the people that broke in stole a box of material, assassination-related material. In this box of material were all of these photographs that Roscoe White had.
Howard says the men who burglarized the White's home were arrested in Arizona with the stolen photos still in their possession.
The police took the material out of the car. They realized it was assassination-related, so they informed the FBI. The FBI comes in, and lo and behold, there's a photograph of Oswald no one's ever seen before.
A year later, in 1976, the stolen photos turn up in Washington, D.C., in the hands of the newly formed House Select Committee on Assassinations. Members of the committee travel to Paris, Texas, to talk with Ricky White and his mother. Out of the blue, they ask Geneva White if she's ever worked for Jack Ruby. She denies it. In 1978, a family friend, who we will call John Doe, warns Ricky that the House Select Committee is going to peg his father as the number one shooter in the Kennedy assassination. Ricky doesn't believe him, but when the committee volumes, Roscoe White's name is mentioned in the investigation.
So even in 78, the House Select Committee knew about Roscoe White, but never followed up on it.
And though Geneva White denied it in the late 70s, what reason would the House Select Committee have to ask if she had ever worked for Jack Ruby? We may never know. But what we do know is that more than 10 years later, Geneva would admit to Ricky that she in fact had worked for Ruby in 1963, just prior to the assassination of the president. That revelation came after her picture was spotted in a magazine with none other than Jack Ruby.
Tomorrow night at 10, a man believed to have been involved in the conspiracy, who we'll call John Doe, confronts Ricky, Midlander Ricky White, about how his father is about to be fingered as the trigger man in the plot of Kennedy's assassination. You won't want to miss it. Those who know who he is will not speak his name, but what we've been able to find out about this man is intriguing. Midlander Ricky White says this family friend came to him in 1978 with a warning. Ricky says that warning was that the House Select Committee on Assassinations was about to key his father, Roscoe White, in the murder of President Kennedy. So who is this man? And why does he claim to know so much? Well, tonight, our series JFK, the West Texas Connection, continues. White's father, Roscoe, died in 1971 after he was burned over 95% of his body in what Ricky says was a suspicious fire. Ricky says 7 years later, in 1978, a family friend told him his father was about to be implicated in the Kennedy killing by the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
And at that time, 2 weeks after our visit, they did come out with a verdict, but they were 99% sure that they was a grassy no assassin. I mean, they couldn't prove who he was or where he came from, but they knew that there was a man standing there at the grassy no.
Still, Ricky says he didn't believe his father's friend, who we will call John Doe, to protect his identity.
He had just got out of the hospital. He had been shot twice in the abdomen and had probably been left to die. And
this person, John Doe.
Yes, he was a very good friend of my father's before he died.
Ricky says he didn't believe what John Doe told him that night in 1978 until 1985 when he started reading his father's diary.
And I came across a part in the diary which was leading up to the assassination. And then that's when I realized that John Doe was telling me the truth.
Ricky says his father's diary didn't become interesting until he read up through the year 1960.
And then from 1960 on, my father lived a very interesting life, a double life than anything that I ever knew of him.
Can you tell us some specifics?
Not a record, I can't. I mean, there's known things that my father was involved with that I'd rather just stick with the John F. Kennedy.
Although Ricky chose to reveal little about John Doe's identity, Reverend Jack Shaw, another family friend, did tell us what Ricky's mother told him about the man.
That person had been doubling for Oswald to give Oswald an alibi or to set Oswald up related to being in another location, specifically in Mexico, coming out of the Russian embassy. I got the impression that he was flying in from somewhere else. Not just him, but others were flying in and would be in place for taking care of the assassination.
Could this man possibly be John Doe?
Yes.
Sources close to John Doe tell us that since he learned of our plans to report on the Kennedy assassination, he has disappeared.
If I tell you that John Doe's name, and if I'm right, will you tell me more?
Well, if you'll turn that camera off where we can talk.
The camera was turned off, and my photographer was told to leave the room. But the name I gave Reverend Shaw, he says, was wrong. So as of this moment, one of the missing links in this story is the true identity of John Doe.
Now remember, it wasn't until Ricky White found his father's diary that Ricky says he believed John Doe was telling the truth, that his father was involved in the Kennedy assassination. But Ricky says it's been difficult to prove. He says the one piece of concrete evidence he had linking his father was taken away. Ricky claims that after the Midland FBI learned of the diary's contents, an FBI agent, apparently on orders, took the diary from his home. You'll hear both sides of that story tomorrow night at 10. Plus, a Midland DA investigator tells about his trip to Dallas in search of the truth. Only when he got there, he wasn't alone. Watch tomorrow night at 10.
Tonight we continue our series of exclusive reports, JFK, the West Texas Connection. In 1971, Roscoe Anthony White, a former Marine and at one time a Dallas police officer, died after a suspicious fire in Paris, Texas. It would be years later before his son, Ricky White of Midland, would come across his father's military footlocker. Time would pass before Ricky would really examine the contents of that box, but when he did, his life would change forever. Among his father's possessions, Ricky found a small black diary. In it, he says, were the shocking details of his father's involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy. Ricky says his father used code names to refer to himself and others who positioned themselves in Dealey Plaza that fateful day in 1963.
His code name was Mandarin, and the other gentleman's name was Lebanon, the guy that was in the book depository, and Saul was located in the records building.
Also
Also among his father's possessions, Ricky says, were a bank bag, a key to a safety deposit box, and a receipt for $200,000. He claims his father, Roscoe White, Jack Ruby, and Dallas police officer J.D. Tippett all had accounts at this bank. When Ricky and his mother, Geneva, checked on getting into the safety deposit box, bank officials told them they would have to probate his father's will, giving them power of attorney. But Ricky said that would have cost a lot of money, money he didn't have. And that's when Ricky says he asked Midland D.A. Al Shorey for help.
This, it led on Al wanting more information.
Him and J.D. Lucky came to the house 3 or 4 times and sat on the couch and went through everything and looked at everything and read everything. I know they came over three times
and went through the same stuff.
Everything, Ricky says, except his father's diary.
Did J.D. Lucky or Al Shorey touch that diary? See it, open it up, look at it,
no,
put anything in your house.
No.
Why was that?
No. I kept it at a distance. I always did. I never did hand it to anybody or give it to them. The people that ever did ever see it or did read it did it without my permission.
One of those people Ricky is referring to was employed as a babysitter. She agreed to an interview, but only if her identity was kept secret.
Did you see the diary? Have you ever seen the diary?
Yes, I have seen the diary, but at the time I did not notice it was a book that I was not supposed to be looking at. I remember seeing names, but I couldn't tell the names. I remember seeing numbers.
Ricky says two Midland FBI agents also looked through the diary without his permission after they came out to his house demanding he bring any assassination-related material he might have to the Midland Federal Building.
It was Butler that introduced himself first to me. And then
Ron Butler.
And Ferris was standing beside him. And I tried to poke him a little bit. And I kind of pissed Butler off. And before I know it, he's pulling out a federal book sitting there, man, not only do I want you to read it, I want you to read it out loud where I understand that you understand what I'm saying. You know, intimidate me.
I've spoken to Ron Butler. He told me on the phone that was never at your house, has no idea where you live, never been there.
That's a downright lie. That's a lie.
The babysitter confirms Ricky's version of the events that day.
I didn't reveal your identity.
Because I'm calling the FBI liars. And they know it and I know it and I know what happened that particular day. And so we're just afraid for us. Or for me. And my family.
The babysitter and Ricky remember loading all of his father's material, including the diary, into a box, and the two FBI agents followed him to the federal building. Ricky says he and the two agents were the only ones in the room, but that a man on a speakerphone asked a lot of questions. He said the two agents referred to the man as Arlen Specter. He is the Pennsylvania senator who had served on the Warren Commission. It was the Warren Commission that determined that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman in the Kennedy assassination.
They keep going over and pounding me about how my father is a thief. He stole these photographs. He made this story up. My mother says, we better get photo stack of copies of it. So he goes over to a Xerox machine, and there's Xerox and everything that was in that box.
So they had a Xerox copy of the diary.
Yes.
Every page in.
Yes.
Ricky says he then loaded the diary and everything back into the box and drove home. Ricky's wife, Tricia, says Ricky was extremely upset when he got home and that he put the box containing the diary on their pool table and headed for the bedroom, vowing he was through trying to prove his story because no one would believe him.
Here I thought that the FBI was people that you would look up and moderate as being trustful people. And here they let me down.
Minutes later, the doorbell rang.
And he said, hi. I was in the office with Ricky while I gone with the FBI, and I left my notepad in the box of stuff he brought home. I said, and I guess you need to get it. He said, yeah. And I told him, I said, well, just follow through there, and it's back on the pool table. So I went back there, and by the time we got to where the door was, Ricky said, who is it? And I turned and went to the doorway. I didn't go in the bedroom. I just went to the doorway. And I said, it's somebody with the FBI. And they said they left their notepad in the box. And as soon as I turned around, he was facing me. He said, thank you very much. I got what I needed. And walked out. And
I contacted the head of the Midland FBI, Tom Kurzweil. Kurzweil was more than cooperative in giving me an official statement on the matter. And while he was not stationed in Midland when all of this happened, he said, quote, we did interview Ricky White. He did bring documents to us. The FBI did not take them from his possession. The documents and interview were of no value. We never saw a diary, and one has never been in our possession.
and the denials of the FBI that they did not see or did not take the diary, from my experience with that agency, just don't wash.
If Ricky White's story is worthless, then why in January of 1988 did the FBI send a special agent to accompany Midland DA investigator J.D. Luckey around Dallas in his search for the truth? Luckey had gone there to look for a safety deposit box in which Ricky White believed his father had stashed $200,000.
Did the FBI accompany you on this trip?
They did.
Did you go and oversee or look at these areas?
The night before and that next morning, we went to the banks and savings loan to see if it was that key that would work in those safety deposit boxes. It did not.
You were aware of a secret document on the City of Dallas Police Department. Investigator Luckey said the FBI had met with Ricky White, had seen the pictures and diary. Is that correct?
I never said that. The FBI, to my knowledge, never saw the diary. We never saw the diary.
How do you think they could make such a mistake on this? I mean, is that easy for...
The only thing I'd say is that he may have misunderstood me.
When our attorney first contacted one of the agents in Midland, he said he almost threw up on the table. And I think that's the approach they've taken about this entire story, because it's very disturbing to them that this is all coming out.
I contacted the Dallas intelligence officer who filed the report on Investigator Luckey and read him the part where he says Luckey made the statement that the FBI had met with Ricky White, had seen the pictures and diary. He told me, quote, "If that's what it says in my report, that's what I was told. My reports are accurate." We also obtained the handwritten notes made by Officer Beavers before the report was typed and turned into the captain overseeing the intelligence division. The handwritten notes match up with the report. So you decide, was there a diary? And if there was, did the FBI take it?
In July of 1990, Ricky White says he discovered something he believes his father had hidden away in the event of his death. In fact, what he would find inside his grandfather's burned-out attic was so unsettling, Ricky says he couldn't tell anyone, not even researchers at the JFK Assassination Information Center in Dallas.
In the metal container, I told you the islands are in there. Now, Ricky kept this book here and wouldn't give it to us. And we couldn't understand why he wouldn't give it to us. If the orders are in there to kill John Kennedy, what could be worse than killing John Kennedy?
Inside the canister and wrapped in plastic, Ricky found three decoded cables with orders to kill John Kennedy, pictures of Ruby shooting Oswald, Roscoe White's dog tags, and this mysterious green book. These are copies of the cables found in the plastic.
It said remarks, Mandarin. Then when Ricky first came to us, he said the diary said his father's code name was Mandarin. Well, lo and behold, it's Mandarin on the cables. It said foreign affairs assignments have been canceled. The next assignment is to eliminate a national security threat to worldwide peace. Destination will be Houston, Austin, and Dallas. Contacts are being arranged now. Orders are subject to change at any time. Reply back if not understood. C. Bowers, OSHA. At the bottom it says RE-Rifle, code AAA, destroy. The second cable says same information at the top. It says remark Mandarin code A, Dallas, destination chosen. Your place hidden within the department. Contacts are within this letter. Continue on as planned. The third cable dated December 1963 says stay within the department. The witnesses have eyes, ears, and mouths. The next word we can't decipher. Due to the mix-up, the men will be in to cover all misleading evidence soon. Stay as planned. Wait for further orders.
And though the cables would be considered possible evidence in the death of our president, the worst was yet to come. What Ricky couldn't bring himself to talk about with anyone could be found inside the Green Book. Researchers call it the Witness Elimination Book, where Roscoe White had listed those he had murdered.
This is two pages out of the Green Book. It's a shorthand book turned upside down, starting in the back, and then newspaper clippings glued onto each page. The picture on the left is of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy If you notice, John Kennedy has a slash across his head. That means he's dead. Oswald's dead, and undoubtedly the girl on the right is dead also. But Robert Kennedy's not. The significance of this, at the very bottom, it says, Godhead going after tail later, which means probably Robert Kennedy. And sure enough, he was assassinated later. Now, that phrase was not known until 1980. That's what Carlos Marcello said to one of his mob figures. We got the head now, we're going to have the tail later. In the back of the book, it says 28 people died under witness program, and then a series of numbers, which we don't know what they mean, and signed Roscoe Anthony White in his signature.
It wouldn't be until Howard, Ricky, and their wives were on their way to Los Angeles to meet with movie director Oliver Stone that Ricky would tell Howard about the Green Book. And though Howard says they met with Stone and he offered to buy the rights to the Roscoe White story, they never mentioned the book that Ricky had taken with them. And as far as accepting Stone's offer, Howard said they turned him down.
I said two reasons. One, the story's not fully investigated yet. It's got some flaws. And two, we're scared to death. If these cables we have are legitimate, there's only four of us in the world that know where they are and who has them, and we feel our lives are in danger.
Howard would later work for Stone as the conspiracy consultant on the movie set of his controversial blockbuster, JFK. It was before they left the Los Angeles airport that Ricky gave Howard the Green Book. And as their plane approached the Dallas airport, something would go terribly wrong.
The plane was coming down, almost touching the runway, and it gave full power and took off again, which is very unusual. It was a 767. It circled the airport two or three times and landed at a remote runway that we didn't even know existed.
Howard says the flight attendants told them to evacuate the plane down the chutes immediately.
So, you know, we're thinking, oh boy, what, you know, what is this? And I'd taken the Green Book because Ricky had given me the Green Book at the LA airport, and I looked at it and put it in my briefcase. It was in the overhead rack. So when people were trying to get out of the plane, I was going the wrong direction because I was going to get the Green Book out because the diary is already missing. So I got it out and stuck it in my pants.
Fortunately, Howard says he and Ricky and their wives made it down the chute safely without injury. But there were others who weren't so lucky.
We were standing there, a black car drives up, FBI. They're circling the plane. Mm-hmm. There are men that got out. The plane is sitting there, nobody around it, and these special government cars drive up. So we get at the airport, we finally get back to the center, and I call a friend of mine that works at Delta. I said, what happened on this flight? He said a bomb threat was called into the LA airport when y'all took off. And in the newspaper article, it says the FBI searched the plane.
Ricky says a small group of independent oil men in Midland now own the rights to the Green Book, and they're having it researched. He says the book is locked up in a safety deposit box or vault somewhere around the tall city.
Those of you that have not purchased my book yet and would like to learn more about the assassination, drop me an email at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com and I will get you a personalized signed copy in the mail. It would make a great gift for anyone interested in the JFK assassination. It is an oversized coffee table style book that is over 500 pages and contains hundreds of pictures, most of them in vibrant color. I can promise you will not be disappointed in the book. The price is $60 for the hardcover and $40 for the softcover. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.